The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 13.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hey folks, Dan here from the Culinary Libertarian Podcast. Happy to have you back. Happy to be here. Find and like my various social media spots on my podcast page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcast, and you can also like my YouTube page. It's kind of my own cooking show. Please do support the show on the Patreon tab, which you can also find on the podcast page. Find the Culinary Libertarian on Apple Podcasts and rate and leave a positive comment. That helps move the show up. And the more people who hear the show are the more people who get cooking. And lastly, please share the show on social media. Share it with your friends who cook. Share it with your friends who eat. Share it with people who like to look at Facebook. Hey folks, today I'm playing an episode on which I appeared on our friend Sherry Voluntary's podcast. We were talking about the book Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Food Rights as it pertains to a libertarian position about food and property rights and, well, kind of just sort of rights in general. We're going to happen when you talk to Sherry. You're going to go all over the place, which is the beauty of talking to Sherry, because you get to go all over the place. So it's a good talk. We had a lot of fun. Talked about a libertarian POTUS for a little bit, just to, you know, see what would happen. And then just some fun food nostalgia when things seemed easier, which, of course, was when we were kids. Anyway, enjoy the episode.
From beautiful East Tennessee in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains, you are listening to the Sherry Voluntary Podcast with Sherry Voluntary. And I'm delighted that you are spending a little time with me today and giving me your valuable time to listen to me and my guests talk about things we find interesting. So as you know, food is something that I think everyone on the planet can relate to because we all have to eat. And some of us like to do it a lot. Like myself. So our guest today is, he's a man that's familiar with the art of making food, and that's Mr. Dan Reed. He has spent most of his working years in kitchens cooking as a chef. He worked up to the position of chef, but is a cook at heart. In addition to cooking, he also is a baker. Same heat, but very different skills, as anyone who's tried to make biscuits knows. And today he's working at his food and baking blog, attempting to crack the code of e-commerce and being dad to two girl beings, girl human beings, that is, and two girl cats that were recently adopted. And that would be the cats, not the girls, correct?
Yes.
So welcome, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
Good. Great. I appreciate you coming on today. So you run the food blog, The Culinary Libertarian.
I do.
Yeah. And how many years have you been doing that?
It's not even 1 year.
Okay.
I think probably it feels like August of 2017 is when I started. The whole reason it came to be is because I heard this guy, Tom Woods, keep saying, get my link and I'll give you a good deal.
Right.
So I was, you know what? This sounds interesting. Maybe I should look into blogging. So I looked into blogging and, well, here we are.
Yeah. So I take it not only are you passionate about food and cooking, but you are also passionate about libertarianism, and that's why the marriage of the two in the blog.
The marriage of the two in the blog, I have to tell you, it seemed like I had to have the libertarian part in there to sort of make it work with the whole Tom Woods deal. It turns out that wasn't true. But the passion for the food and baking certainly is there. As I started listening to Tom's show, I came to Tom sort of late, within maybe the last year or so, listened to a wide variety of other right-wing kinds of people, and more and more found they were alienating me.
Sure.
And so they're all sort of almost punchline jokes these days. But then found Tom and some of the basics of libertarianism make sense. It's don't hurt people, don't take their stuff.
Right.
It can get a lot more complicated, which I realized when you're talking about not just taxation, we're talking about minimum wage things, talking about government intervention in any way,
yeah,
either hurting you or taking your stuff or doing both of those. And libertarianism is a really big bite, pun intended. So that I'm learning a lot about.
Yeah.
But what I'm learning about, I'm liking, because it doesn't seem that we are getting anything that looks like a solution. Now, the right question is, what does a solution look like? Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to answer. I asked a mutual friend of ours that question. I said, you know, if libertarians are not altogether interested in voting because it doesn't really produce much, and no reasonable libertarian that we would want to vote for would run for office, what does a win look like? And his answer is that it starts at the local thing. Do in the house, do in the community. So I think that that's where it needs to really come from. And the two then become something that you can pair together.
Right.
Liberty in lots of different ways. It's not just liberty from the United States government. It's liberty from any kind of oppression, even at the local level. And so that seems to be the place to start. And that's, well, it's not exactly where I'm kind of doing everything all at once, but trying to get some feel of it all. And what got you and me together was the FDA and the food. And so,
yeah, there's a lot of regulation surrounding that that is totally unnecessary. So, yeah, I think you share a lot of people's feeling. I know for me, you know, I used to be a Republican a long time ago, and I really felt like they left me. The more I learned about freedom, the less I felt they represented anything that I wanted to be a part of. So then, you know, I found libertarianism, and it still took me a while. You know, once I heard the word libertarian, I didn't know for a while what that really meant. I didn't realize there was a philosophy that went along with that. And so I think you're kind of lucky in that way to get in understanding there's a philosophy to it, because I didn't hear a lot of the things regarding the philosophy until many years after I considered myself a libertarian. So it definitely was a spectrum for me, and it took a while. But once, you know, the joke, how long is it between libertarianism and anarchism, being a libertarian anarchist, is 6 months. Like, so that was sort of true for me. Once I found the philosophy, it didn't take very long at all before, you know, I came to the realization that the state is a problem and that it is the great oppressor of people and actually inhibits them from having agency in their own lives to make their own choices and have a satisfaction in life that is hard to come by when you're being told what to do and what not to do constantly. So I think that's, you know, not that people have to be anarchists. I always say that too. Like I'm not advocating that everyone, you know, anyone who's not a full anarchist is not a libertarian. Like I think that anarchism represents the fullness of libertarian philosophy. But, you know, I feel that people could have different points of view on that. I don't really care what they call themselves, as long as they agree with me not to hurt me and not to take my stuff, and I'll agree with them, and we can move on from there.
I agree. And it's, so that same fellow, well, I guess we'll use his name because he's in public eye, Daniel Wood at Actual Anarchy. We had a little message chat this morning about how labels seem in some very real way to be both an anchor and a burden and an impediment for a variety of reasons. Now, we, you know, the old, I think it was Plato's cave allegory where, you know, the one guy gets out and says, oh my gosh, look what's outside the cave. And nothing's outside the cave. How dare you? There is, and we all recognize, there's a comfort in what you know, and what you don't know can be just horrifically terrifying. So I'm not insensitive to the fact that this word, it sounds weird, libertarianism. It's long, it's hard, it's clunky. I thought for years it was just some alternative to Republican. Yeah. I didn't realize
Republicans who want to smoke weed, right?
Why not? Sure. Even if you don't want to, why not? So labels are hard. I use the word to, well, truthfully, segregate from the R and the D. Yeah. But it does come with some sort of, you can see, even in, if not in their faces, in their Facebook responses or anything else, like, oh, those guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that label does seem to get in the way of having any kind of a conversation about anything at all. Because, you know, we remember this fellow getting near naked in Orlando a couple of years ago, and this is what libertarian is. Well, yeah. No, it really isn't. Everyone seems to be willing to affix a label to the last thing they saw on TV, no matter who it is.
Right. And I think that's a good point, that labels are both helpful. I always see them as helpful. And so you need labels in order to communicate, right? We need to know what our starting points are. But to assume that you understand where someone, all of their life, because we're all so multifaceted, and that you understand all of their beliefs just because of a label is a mistake. So that's where labels can be good to help start a conversation. But if you try and box people in with a label, then you're not doing yourself or them any service, because if you want to understand people and where they're coming from, then you have to listen to them, and we're all going to have our different opinions on those things. So it's like anything else. It's a tool. Labels are tools. And so we, you know, you label the stuff in your cabinet, so you know you're grabbing, you know, salt, not arsenic. You know, those are important distinctions. Not that,
well,
I keep,
yes,
arsenic,
yes,
next to my salt.
I was
going to
ask, but I'm glad you volunteered, Ms. Voluntary, that you, yes, don't actually have arsenic in your kitchen.
Yeah. No, not today, anyways. Who knows?
All right, then.
I have a 15-year-old who loves science projects of all sorts, so we'll see. But so you read a book recently, and you were kind of discussing it in a group that we're a part of. And
yes.
I was really interested in what you were saying about it. So we decided to have this conversation. And the name of the book is Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Food Rights by,
correct,
a man named Gumpert. I remember his last name. I can't think of his first name, but
I think his first name is David.
David, yes. David Gumpert. And so this book is really interesting. I haven't finished reading it. I've only started it. But I found it, especially the introduction, seemed very libertarian in a lot of ways, because they talk about, you know, your rights. Although I did want to say that, you know, he's coming to it from a point of calling it a right. And it's really not a right to have people produce for you, because, you know, we know the difference between positive and negative rights, and that there are no real positive rights. That you have rights to not be inhibited, but you don't have right to, you know, oblige other people to do things for you or provide services for you. So it's an interesting way to frame the conversation. I think he did that, called it a right, because maybe he does believe it's a right, but it seems more like he recognizes that, but that you have to sort of engender people's emotions in order to get them to listen to what you're trying to say. Of course, we have a right to make choices. So if you could say a right to food choices, maybe that covers it. Not real sure.
I was talking with an attorney asking the question, do you have a right to food? And the obvious answer, his answer was no.
Right.
The caveat would be, in his opinion, you have a right to the food that you produce. And if you're the farmer and I want to buy from you the things you produce, then there isn't a right to commerce, there isn't a right to trade, but that's a liberty we have. That's a freedom that you can exchange with me. I will exchange my paper money for you,
right,
and you will give me the cow, the corn, the milk, the cheese, the butter, whatever it is, and we'll both say that I value your product more than my money, and we're on the way.
Right.
So do you have the right to pursue food? Well, that's not really, you calling it a right is going to get people invested in the conversation, but calling it a right doesn't make it one,
right,
any more than calling this a necktie doesn't make it a necktie. It's still a sticky pad. So I think that's one of the problems we get into in having discussions about rights, having, mm-hmm, discussions about things that are important to us. Food and water and healthcare are important to us, but because we call them a right, it doesn't magically turn them into one, mm-hmm, but it certainly gets people talking. we wouldn't be as excited if we talked about anglets, which are the little piece of plastic on the end of the shoelace.
Right.
Who cares? If I reach an anglet, fine. Go have some more. I don't care. But talk about food or water or healthcare or something else, you know, or guns. But we're not going to talk about that.
Right.
But it gets the conversation started. The problem, I think, is the conversation had is often an ill-informed conversation, and now we aren't. Maybe we're getting back to people who have labels that wish not to be moved from the position that the label identifies.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes actual conversation, real dialogue, real progress nearly impossible. So we get these intractable loggerheads of pro and con on any issue that's important, and we don't really get anywhere.
Right. It is a good, I often think to myself, how do you get people to change their positions? Because, and that's what we want to do. We want to change people's positions. And, you know, we have to also be open to being changed. And I think a lot of times it boils down to like mirroring what they say they believe. If they say they believe in freedom, then we have to the best of our ability, mirror that back to them when they say things that aren't pro freedom at all, like you must stand for the national anthem or you know, things like that that have nothing to do with whether a person is a good American or not. So I think that it's an interesting question that's we all have to ask at times, but I'm not sure that, you know, what exactly the solution is. All I know is that we have to keep talking to people, and that will grow because we all are on a spectrum, right? We all start somewhere and hopefully we never arrive, because then you stop learning and you might be dead. So I don't want to do that, or be a zombie.
Well, no, I mean, that part's going to come no matter what. But you mentioned the word mirroring. And so because I've been reading a lot, one of, you know, our mutual relationships is the Tom Woods Show. And he recently had a fellow on, Chris Voss, who wrote the book, I Never Split the Difference, which is about negotiations. Now, you know, Chris has some great stories, all the juicy bits about his job, but then turns those juicy bits into very useful things to use, ways to negotiate in real estate or in business or in, you know, husband and wife or parents and kids. And so one of the things, by the time I finished the book, what I realized, which you have to get, he doesn't say up front, but maybe he doesn't, I missed it. Anytime two people are talking is an opportunity for a negotiation.
Sure.
Now, it's not like they show on TV and in the movies. That's, well, it's sometimes
TV and the movies.
Terrible writing. But so one of the first lessons in his book is mirroring. It's learning how to listen, learning to hear what is the other person saying. And because you may not agree with the words, doesn't mean that it's immediately an adversarial relationship.
Right.
And if that's how you approach it, well, I can tell you what's going to happen.
Yeah, you turn it into
so,
that.
Learning to listen, learning to hear, it requires, at least on some level, being able to get your counterpart to also listen and hear. Progress can happen, but it isn't going to be quick.
Yeah.
But I think that in any conversation we want to have, we can get there. The Gumpert's book, it covers, to me, three main things. It covers vendors who are selling raw milk and raw milk products to people who want them. The farmers who are making the raw milk and raw milk, well, they're not, the cow's making it, but either turning the raw milk into cheeses or other usable food products. And then some court trials that went on and how some communities responded to creating a situation where the federal government is, by definition of the contract, excluded from interfering.
Mm-hmm.
So the book was fairly, a lot eye-opening in the fact that there are some judges, and I wrote up down here that they think that, I don't know who the they are exactly because I have to go and get the exact details, but that a judge decided that the people had no right to the food they grow and had no right to feed the children a particular food. That, now that's going to stick into people's craws and say, well, hang on just a minute.
Right.
So I don't have a right to the food I grow in my garden. I go out into the woods and cut down a bunch of trees and build a house. What's to say that the same interpretation means that I don't have a right to my homestead?
Right.
Well, if I didn't build it and I just bought it, even though that's a contract, what right? I mean, it seems to me a horribly slippery slope.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem at all absurd to think that we could get on this slippery slope looking at how policies has been carried out in the last 20 years.
Yeah. It kind of, you know, as shocking as it sounds at face value, when you think about it a little bit, it really all flows from the idea that you don't own yourself, that they don't understand that people own themselves completely. That's what our whole system is based on, the state anyways. And, you know, they can tell you to put a seatbelt on in the car. You have no agency in whether or not you do, because you can, but you're going to get a fine. You're going to get harassed and pulled over on the street because you chose to do something that is risky, that the state doesn't like. If I can't say no, then I have no rights, because the right to say no to dissent is what makes something voluntary. And so I think that's a really important thing to remember, that since we own ourselves completely, of course we would own the product of our labor. I don't think there's anything, if they can tell you that you don't have a right to the food that you grow yourself, then why do you have a right to pick the soap you use in the shower? Or why do you have a right to pick, you know, the toothpaste that you use? Because if they know what's best for all of us, then maybe they should just pick everything and give us, you know, our what we can get, and we'll go to the stand in the line and get it. I mean, that sounds like a completely, you know, where that goes. I mean, that it leads to nowhere good. So I think that's a really good point to remember, that it all stems from that one idea of who really owns us. And I think, you know, to them being the political elite, that we are, you know, the tax farm, and we're domesticated people for them. So to use at will, and that's the kind of attitude that we want to fight. So yeah, I think that was a good point that you brought up in the book. It sort of reminds me of, you know, the Interstate Commerce Clause, I think is what it was called. I've got some information about it here, where 1842 is when, I think it came into effect before that, but that's when they really started using the Interstate Commerce Clause to get into a lot of different areas of people's lives. And there was an Ohio farmer called Roscoe Filburn. And he was growing wheat for his own consumption. And so they got upset, the state did, with him, because they said that him not buying feed on the open market, instead feeding that to his animals, would cause a problem with interstate commerce. And that was why they had a right to say, you know, stop him from feeding his own animals, is because he wouldn't be spending the money in the market. It's ridiculous, but that is the state for you. And the way they think, it said to have a substantial economic effect on interstate commerce. And then in 1933, when FDR, he had like 6 million pigs slaughtered, millions of acres of land they paid farmers to till under, especially in the South, cotton plantations or crops, that in order to create scarcity, so the prices would go up when you have people who can't pay for those prices. I mean, it was ridiculous in the way that they carried that out. But even there, you see where they're involving themselves in the production of those kinds of, you know, goods, food, and cotton for materials, textiles, and things, that they really do believe that they have the authority and the right to get in between the market, the consumer, and the producer, and kind of intercede in that somehow. And usually, if they don't, you know, it's not to say everything will be perfect, but it would probably be much better if they weren't interceding in those ways and protecting us from ourselves. So in the book, one of the things that the first story that they start out with talks about the truck coming from up north, from Amish farms, I believe it was, to Florida, I think, to a food club. And these people were buying raw products. What really caught my attention about that was the kombucha that they mentioned there, because my son used to, I don't know if you say grow or make or ferment kombucha, you kind of do all those things with it, right. But that there was meat, like thousands and thousands of dollars worth of food that the government decided they didn't like, that people were eating it without the FDA approval. And so
the meat didn't have the USDA stamp.
Right.
The one thing missing on that meat. And so, as he tells the story, but having been in food, I can look at a piece of meat, and pretty much anybody who's handled meat, if it's slimy and smelly and it has things moving on it, Well, that's probably not something you want to eat anyway. So it's automatically selling it as being out. Wholesome fish, chicken, meat, whatever it is, doesn't smell bad. Mm-hmm. It has an odor to it. In some cases, fish doesn't have an odor to it, but that's another story. But it's easy to discriminate wholesome from unwholesome. And the fact that this meat didn't have a little purple sticker was all that the FDA needed to throw it just buried in a landfill. Did you get to the part about the lady holding the picnic in her farm, in her in the corn rows? It's coming up. Same problem. She raised this meat. So the people who raise the farmers, who knows better the health of an animal than a farmer?
Right.
I don't know, but maybe a vet. But the person tending the animal knows best the health of the animal. So they raised and slaughtered and cooked and fed this meat, these people, and they were made to throw the food away.
Right. I might butcher this, but it reminds me of a quote because I love Star Trek. So
was that a joke, butcher?
No. There's a quote by Jean-Luc Picard from the show where he says it's either for the common good or it's for the good of the people, something to that effect, is the age-old cry of the oppressor. And it's so very true that you can say that, well, I'm doing this because I love you, like so many abusers say. It still doesn't make it not abuse. And so,
right.
There's not been a crime committed. It's like, you remember that movie Vanilla Sky, I think it was, or the one where they had the
Oh my
the future
God, you
crime?
Watched Vanilla Sky?
Was that the one where they had the...
A piece of crap.
Right. Or maybe it was Minority Report. The one where they have the... Okay. That was it.
It was Minority Report. Sorry. Fundamentally different movies.
Yes. It's been a long time since I've seen either one.
Holy moly.
I know Philip K. Dick wrote Minority Report, or wrote the short story that became Minority Report, which I love his work too. So in that, they have the thought crime where they can predict somehow that people are going to commit a crime. And it's sort of like that, well, you might get hurt. Your kids aren't wearing their helmet outside. Well, the state, we have to take them from you because they might get hurt. You can oppress people for their own good, you can use that as an excuse for anything.
Well, but Sherry, it's the government. They automatically know better. Don't you know that?
Right, exactly. I used to sort of believe that, I guess, or I believed they didn't believe that. Now I really see that they do, unfortunately. So with this book, I really liked the style of, he was just sort of taking stories and sort of expounding what happened to let people know. It seemed like that was really what his purpose was to inform people that these things are going on, and that, do you really want to be told what you can eat and what you can't, what you can ingest? And it flows right along with, say, the drug war and really anything else. Is that who are you to tell me what I can put in my body if, I own this property? It is me. I own myself. I'm not harming you. I'm not damaging you or your property or inhibiting you or your rights. So you have no right to tell me, what to do. I mean, it comes down to, even we think they're ridiculous in, New York State, where you can't get certain size cola or trans fats. But those same people who think that's ridiculous.
Two of the small ones.
Exactly. The same people, though, that think that's ridiculous are also, well, I'm not for marijuana in my community, and of course, great, don't smoke it if that's, or ingest it in some way if that's what you want. But how do peaceful people become criminals because a third party says they are? That really, I think that's fundamental to all of this kind of discussion is, are you really want to arrest people? I mean, the driver of that truck, they threw him in jail for a little while. And they, did they really want to throw people in jail for just exercising their lives? It's not like they're doing anything to harm anyone. So I thought it was a good illumination of the kind of things that are going on. Many things I didn't know about. Like, I think he says in there that the war against raw milk, he called it, has been raging for like 100 years. I never would have guessed that.
There was, pretty old age, we'll say, battle. And he actually has another book about raw milk. There was a point in time less than 100 years ago when that was just a bit, you just got it.
Yeah.
And he, at some point, he starts to break down sort of in a time frame how things changed and started. So in 1906 was the Pure Food and Drug Act, which turned into the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act in 1938. That's where the whole idea of food of your own choice is not something you actually have anymore. So you were trying to make a joke about making a choice about the soap on the shelf, when according to the FDA, most of the stuff that's in the store has been determined for you.
Right.
So you're not really making your choice. You're making your choice from the 3x5 part of allowable opinion to steal somebody else's tagline. You don't really have that. You don't have complete full autonomy. And if you remember the Jack in the Box problem back in the early 80s, happened out. I was in Michigan at the time. I remember as a kid, Jack in the Box in the Metro Detroit area, that was the place to go get a hamburger. And then, boom, they just like disappeared. Mm-hmm. And they took forever to come back. And somebody, I don't remember all the details, but some people got very sick, and I think some people died in Seattle at a Jack in the Box. This very young, ambitious lawyer took the case and made food safety a huge, huge thing and built an enormous practice from that, pursuing food safety stuff. And as is often the case, the overcorrection is worse than the problem. And right. We're kind of, I don't know where we are in the pendulum, but we are getting more and more people who are, whether or not they're libertarians, I don't know, but they're seeking either for their own choice or for legitimate health benefits, raw milk, either cow or sheep or goat, raw cheeses. And we were at a cheese fest a couple weekends ago, and they were selling goat cheese. We bought some. It's really good.
Yeah.
The principal complaints, as Gumpert relays them in the book, are, of course, well, someone could get sick. Well, yes. Somebody could get hit by a car. Somebody could have an anvil dropped. You know, we could be, you know, Bugs Bunny and, you know, anvils on the head and the Three Stooges. And you, to try to protect against every possibility, well, then we can never leave the house.
Right.
Because anything can happen. At some points in Australia, a Skylab fell to the earth. Oh, my God.
Right.
Space chunks falling. Then we can't leave. So the FDA, in their drug and medical applications, and Higgs brings this up in his book, Against Leviathan, and so they're doing the same thing with food, is as the central planner, there's really only one way to do this, and that is the most oppressive way possible.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed, so no central planner, of course, can know all of the circumstances, all of the situations, and all of the people's willingness to assume risk,
right.
Which was your point earlier. If I'm willing to assume risk by driving my car without a seatbelt, then that's my problem.
Mm-hmm.
Having the seatbelt and not having the seatbelt probably doesn't impact my skill as a driver. If I'm wearing a seatbelt and I hit somebody and kill him, well, the seatbelt's a material. That's a whole other problem.
Let's take a moment for a word from one of my affiliates. Folks, with a few days left before Christmas dinner, check my affiliate, D'Artagnan, for some excellent selections of Wagyu beef, ducks, geese, as well as foie gras and truffles. Click to culinarylibertarian.com/D'Artagnan holiday. That's culinarylibertarian.com/DARTAGNAN holiday. Or see the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/13.
If I'm willing to assume risk as a terminal patient and I want the drug this company's making, even if the FDA, who mandates the tests that have to happen, the kinds of tests that have to happen, the verbiage you hear in the commercial, this may cause double blindness and your arms to fall off and you may grow hair where you don't want it. those lines, those things have to say are mandated by the FDA, and they cannot say anything that's off the script. So
it's sort of a vicious cycle too, don't you think? I mean, because,
well, it's horrible.
Yeah. And the more encroachment we have into our lives, state encroachment, the more we get, because like what you're saying now, you know, we have seatbelt laws to protect us from our own self and accidents. And we have all these different nanny state type of laws. And now you get into healthcare. Well, I've heard the argument from people, why should I pay for you if you're not going to wear your seatbelt and you get hurt worse than you would have been? then yes, we have a right to tell you that you should wear your seatbelt. So it goes further and further down that road, and the more entrenched it becomes, the harder it is to fight. So, I mean, we know from just living life and seeing how things work, that the more power that the state gets, the harder it is to rein that in and to bring it back. It's a much harder battle to fight to regain power, regain freedom, than it is to give it away. It's just like, you know, getting fat. Like, it's so much easier to get fat than it is to get it off. I wish that were the case. But so, you know, it really is the same with the state. It's much more work, and you have to convince so many more people to get involved. I mean, if you're going to go the political process route, then it seems that can be really daunting sometimes. Although I do think the future is bright. I have a lot of faith in my fellow man in a lot of ways. And I hope that faith will be borne out, because I don't know, some days I'm like, and nobody wants freedom. Nobody wants to, you know, be responsible for themselves. But I really think people, if they experience it a little bit and they really understand that, I guess I see where people are coming from, that they have a lot of compassion, but it's often misplaced. And so instead of being compassionate on individuals about their needs and how I can help them as an individual, to say to a proxy, well, if I give you money, will you take care of my brother? It's sort of a roundabout way to do things. So I think if we could just, you know, keep pushing the messages that we're pushing, maybe it'll start to break through. And I think it is in a lot of ways. And you look at like drug laws with, you know, cannabis, in parts of the country where states have legalized it. I would love to see it decriminalized, but it's a step in the right direction. I think the same with raw milk. I remember back in the 90s, I lived in Wisconsin, the late 90s, and I tried to get raw milk from a farmer that lived next door. Well, I did get the milk from them. This was, Colorado a few years later is where I was living, and I couldn't get the raw milk there. I had been drinking it in Wisconsin, and then I couldn't get it in Colorado because every dairy I called was like, are you kidding me? I could lose my farm because I sold you raw milk. I can't do that. So that was like a big wake-up call. Like, what in the world? Why would that be an issue? Like, milk from the cow that day is not going to harm me. It was a real eye opener, even though it didn't really wake me up at that point. I didn't go, well, that's ridiculous. You know, I should be able to ingest what I want. I was still sort of bought into the system that, well, I know they've got their reasons and I'm sure people could get hurt or, you know, whatever. But I think, you know, it just takes time for people to come to those sorts of realizations that, you know, taking a risk, everything in life is a risk. So I should be able to take my own risks and not, you know, being prohibited from doing that. With the book, there was a quote in here that I did want to read. And it seems like the person who wrote it, Joel Salatin, I didn't have an opportunity to look him up. But I don't know if he's a libertarian or do you know who he is?
I do.
Okay. He seemed, there were some of the things he said that seemed very libertarian. I don't know that he is, but he certainly understands that he owns himself, because he says in there, who owns me? God, my neighbor, society? If I am simply a societal asset like copper fittings on an assembly line, then certainly society has a justified vested interest in keeping me from engaging in risky behavior that may land me in the hospital or in an insane asylum. It has an interest in keeping me out of churches that may make me an unproductive social asset. But if society does not own me, what if I am free to practice my own beliefs and actions, even if someone considers them risky? Generally, personal rights extend as far as my neighbor's nose. I can be noisy unless the noise infringes. So he goes on from there, but to talk about how he owns himself. And I thought that's, you know, I wonder if he's read Rothbard or something, because
I don't know. I ran into his name first in Michael Pollan's The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Okay.
And which was a spectacular book, very well researched. I don't think Michael Pollan is a libertarian, but Michael Pollan certainly is interested in liberating food from the hands of those who would oppress us with it.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that stuck out to me about Joel was his chicken farm. As I remember, at least the story, often had FDA regulators showing up and trying to correct him on how he was slaughtering chickens. And his statement to them and in the book was, the single best disinfectant on the planet is sunshine and fresh air. So he would process these chickens in on a concrete slab, and there was stainless steel tables and possibly a roof, but no walls. And again, so here we are with people whose job it is to handle the chickens. They know what they're doing, at least at the time. If you wanted a chicken from Polyface Farms, you had to go drive and get it. They didn't mail it. They didn't freeze it. You want it? Come butcher one day, today, tomorrow, the next day, whatever it is, come and get it. Yeah. So he has been a very vocal and important person in the, well, we'll call it the food rights movement, but we'll just call it the food movement.
Sure.
So he's got several books out and books like this. He writes prefaces, and I have never met him. I've never talked to him, but he's definitely an important person.
Sure. I think it's good to remember, and this goes back to libertarianism, that it really doesn't matter what someone calls themselves, whether even they know that they're, say, a libertarian as far as the philosophy goes, that the important part is that they come to the understanding that they have freedom, and that to protect their freedom, they need to protect your freedom as well. So, you know, like the food rights, you know, movement, as they're calling it, that's a great way. If people start thinking more about people's rights, the individual's rights to ingest things, then maybe that leads to further conversations and further conversions into a freer mindset of thinking. And that's what we want. I don't care what people call themselves, honestly.
Right.
What I care about is that they want to get to a place where we can all live and be comfortable and have agency in our own lives. That's really what's important. And you mentioned Michael Pollan, which he wrote The Botany of Desire too. And I love that book. It's amazing. The research in there is just really wonderful. And it's just such an interesting historical look at food. But also in it, let's see, what do they call it? You may know. It's been a long time since I've read it. But he talks about how, you know, in the grocery store now, we have like three varieties of potato. And we have one kind of banana. And it's weird. There's not a lot of biodiversity being represented anymore. So it's changing. You need that biodiversity in the environment, I guess. And so our food choices, or what food choices, what is being presented to us in the grocery stores and what we're getting used to is what we'll continue to buy. And so it doesn't promote those different varieties being grown because it works in a market where I'm going to give people what they want so that I can make my money and live my life and buy the things I need. So I wonder how, you know, I thought that's a really interesting subject. And I wonder if you had any insight into, you know, biodiversity and how that can, what maybe we could do as consumers to kind of generate more of that, or if it's important. Maybe he's wrong about that and it's not important. I don't know.
Well, I don't know a lot about it. I think part of the reason tomato A wins out over tomato B is because tomato A can be picked green and shipped across the country and still be presentable. I think that general idea applies pretty much all produce that you see. What's going to ship for the furthest and hold the longest,
right,
for the most resale possibility. The solution to that, and so, well, let me back up a minute. Where I lived in northern Michigan, there were probably hundreds of kinds of apples.
Yeah.
Now, when you go to the store, if you see 20, that's a lot. But it's kind of picking winners and losers because of what's going to ship, what can you make the most of, what's cost efficient to ship. If I can only ship 5 cases of this kind of apple, well, it's just not worth it because it's new, no one's going to buy it. So the way that biodiversity can at least be preserved to the extent that the local people can advantage of it is go pick when apple season comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Wherever you live in this part of the world, I don't know in Tennessee if they have lots of apple trees, but in this part of Oregon and certainly in the old part of Michigan and New Jersey, where you've got lots of apples, go pick them. If you can find an old apple orchard that's had apples, go get them. Now, another one of our libertarian friends, Brian McClanahan's catchphrase, it's a good one, is think locally, act local.
Right.
And which gets us back to what Daniel and I were talking about. How do we win? Well, it depends. First, what do you define as a win?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think necessarily having a libertarian POTUS is a win, because that's one person against 538 or some crazy number. And it's just, that's, yeah, fine, great, woohoo, we get a libertarian president, big deal. What does that do for you at your table? What does that do for me at my table? Not really much of anything.
Yeah.
What can I do by my shopping choices? A whole lot more.
Yeah.
So the local eggs, local beef, local chicken, local apples, local pears, cherries, whatever you've got. Yeah, we buy Chilean fruit because, well, It's there. It's what we have.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was thinking about something you said with, you know, you hear about the local food movement or, you know, buying locally and how that can be important and or eating seasonally, because that can, you know, help people to like in food in the seasons, there aren't that many times of year that sweet things are in season. So,
right.
You know, it keeps you kind of moderate in your food choices, just as far as my health aspect. With the president thing, I think for me, the best thing about having a libertarian president would be the gridlock that it would create in the state system. I mean, that's my goal of if I don't vote nationally, but if there's going to be a third party presence, I want it to be to create gridlock. That's all I want to end the state in that way and the force that it has upon people. So I think if they can do less, that's great, because every time they do things, it usually has unintended consequences that make my life harder.
Helping,
so
please.
Yeah,
don't help so much.
I think that's please. The real benefit of any kind of third party actual political power. So you said you lived in Upper Michigan, and or
yes.
You lived in Michigan. I used to live in the UP myself, up on the Keweenaw Peninsula.
Well, I'm sorry about that. Oh my God.
Yeah. So we had like 42 feet of snow the first year I was there, and it
was August, right?
Yeah. It wasn't that far into the winter. Yeah, it was. It's a beautiful place, and the people there are wonderful.
It is gorgeous, and I've been in many places in the UP. we went to Whitefish Point, and Michigan Tech. It's gorgeous up there. Copper Mountains, very beautiful. Lake Superior is one damn cold lake.
Yes,
always. I was in an elementary school when the Edmund Fitzgerald sank.
Oh, really?
And okay. Yeah, my mother knew some people from the Maritime Academy in Traverse City who were on the boat. So that was a very sad time in Traverse City when that went down.
Yeah,
there was Underwood Orchards had pears and plums and peaches and apples, and this is the first time I was ever in a giant orchard picking all kinds of things. And of course, Traverse City is the cherry capital of the world, so you have to go cherry picking, which was great fun.
Yeah.
So getting fruit eaten within an hour of picking, there's not a lot. I mean, if you can do that, no matter what it is, grow a zucchini, grow an acorn squash, grow something, pick it and eat it. To know how great produce can taste,
yes,
is like, wow, it makes the store stuff taste like cardboard.
Yeah, that was one of the things that bothered me, actually, when I moved to Upper Michigan, because their growing season really isn't that long. So, you know, they shipped in a lot of things green because there was no way to preserve, you know, for there. So I was really starved for fresh produce when I lived there because I
get a lot of whitefish, though.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't like fish. That's the thing. And they, you know, did the smoked fish, what do they call it? Then the tents, you know, they'd have like a teepee and they smoke the stuff up there. And it's just a beautiful part of the world. I just, when you mentioned that, it reminded me that of living there. So I would love to visit in like the 2 weeks of summer that they have. It's amazing. But yeah, it's a tough place to live if you're not loving the cold. And I'm not really a cold weather, shovel in, shovel out type of girl. So it was an interesting 2 years.
Yeah.
But let's move on a little bit now to, unless you have anything, maybe summation of the book and what you thought the best takeaway.
Well, the book is worth reading, partly just to find out the extent to which the FDA is willing to go to destroy product and make criminals of otherwise normal law-abiding people just trying to make a living. These aren't armed thugs going and stealing stuff. These are just people trying to feed their families and raise their kids.
Yeah.
And they're about as far away from criminal as I can imagine. To get some sense of what the scope of this is, it's worth reading the book. I think the author probably feels that there is a right to pursue the food, and that might just be one of those distinctions without a difference. That's opinion in any event. It's not fact, but it's definitely something that I think lots of people who are interested in food and finding some way out from under the thumb of our overlords would be well to read.
Yeah, I'm interested. I'm excited to finish reading it because I think it's just good to have an awareness of this kind of thing that's going on and that encroachment. It's just one more argument in the arsenal of reminding people that they can be self-sufficient or at least self-directed, that, you know, right. Not everybody has to live off the grid. You know, that's not what I'm saying, but that, you know, that I can make a choice and it's okay. It doesn't have to be regulated to high heaven in order to be okay for me. And so I think that's really important. I don't know if you remember a few years ago and being in the industry that you're in, you may where some bureaucrat, little cone-headed, pencil-pushing bureaucrat that went into that artisanal cheese makers and saw them aging cheese on wood boards. And
yes.
Yeah, it got his panties in a twist. And so
big one.
Yeah, and almost ruined an entire industry that has been around far longer than the United States government has been around. And you know, that much power could be in the hands of one little nerdy bureaucrat is insane. And he's someone who is he doesn't understand the food industry if he thinks that's dangerous. It might be. It's a risk, maybe, but...
It's not. They've been aging Parmigiano-Reggiano for about 600 years in Italy on wood boards. And as far as I can tell, Italy is still populated by Italians.
It's one of those things where you go, I can't believe that people are actually taking this seriously. Yeah, so...
Well, it was a big deal because there's a small cheese company called Sweetgrass Dairy in Thomasville, Georgia.
Okay.
And when I was sous chef at a private dining club in Tallahassee, they came knocking on the door and they said, we're fairly local. We're making this cheese. So we started buying it. And it was fantastic and still is. They won awards. They've been in business now for 20 years. But I called them. I said, wow, what's this going to do to you? Well, this might be a hit. Well, luckily it all, I think, finally went away. But it was a real concern for the small cheese people who depend on that product for their livelihood. And so,
I think
Fred Blassie's pencil neck geeks are everywhere.
I think that's one of the ways that Facebook, that social media is really, really valuable because in the internet in general, information can travel at the speed of light. Like it's amazing. And so it's much harder to have these things go on behind the scenes and than it used to be. So now you get one person sharing the story or writing a little article on it and then boom, everybody knows about it. And people in the country are going, this is ridiculous. You can't let them ruin an industry over this. And it really did stop that. And I think a lot of that is due to social media and people sharing those articles.
Right.
I learn a lot of stuff on there. I mean, you know, we have to be careful. I'm not above posting some fake news. I've done it before, you know, or being misinformed, you know, but it's one of those things where I think it's more beneficial than not. And even some of the fighting on Facebook, I think is beneficial, you know, because there's that old, you know, it's a Bible verse, but it's iron sharpeneth iron. And I think that we need to be able to talk to people and have those, if we can have a disagreement and not an argument and learn from each other and consider other points of view, I think that really advances our ideals. So I think it's more beneficial than not. I know people may disagree, but
well, that's okay.
I love it.
That's the beauty of it. They don't have to agree.
Right. Yes, exactly. I do what I want. Now you're I wanted to talk a little bit about your website, The Culinary Libertarian, which I really think is a really great website. I like how you've got it set up.
Thank you.
Yeah. And
well, I think so too, but you know.
Yeah.
People have discriminating taste.
Right. For me, it's about ease of use for one. That's the first thing. Because anyone who has listened to anything I've had to say for very long knows that I'm not the most technologically savvy person in the world. As you found out when we tried to start this interview.
That's all right.
So ease of use is a big deal for me. And two, I don't want to waste a lot of time trying to find information. If you've categorized it, it should be easy to find. That's the whole point. So, but I thought it was interesting where you have kitchen as your first little pull-down menu.
Trying to be clever and try not to take everything too seriously. I mean, kitchen culture can be an aggressive and abusive place, but for a website, try to make it sort of female. dynamic.
Yeah, like Gordon Ramsay, would you consider him?
Well, you know, so I've never met him. He had, there was some UK shows where, because Fox has a business model, and the business model is over the top. So Gordon seems to be able to find access to over the top pretty easily.
Yeah.
I worked for some chefs. I worked for the first certified master chef, who was a Czechoslovakian, who, well, he could have value. He was an amazingly talented person, but chefs, it's certainly European chefs, but back in the day, were not known for their kindness and their compassion.
Right.
So Gordon can channel that pretty easily, but he's also turns out to be an astonishingly compassionate, kind fellow. On the UK show, you see that. Now, you can still call you a donkey if you're screwing up.
Right.
There's that. Lots of chefs and lots of cooks will do mm-hmm. that. So, yeah, I mean, there's it is a carryover still from the old French model, mm-hmm. which, good or bad, probably mostly bad, but they were some good cooks, so we sort of take the bad with the good. The French's contribution to cooking was mastering the sauce.
Sure.
The Italians taught the French how to cook. The French Escoffier took sauce making to an entirely new level and put them on the culinary map.
That's I love Northern Italian food for that reason, because it's more, it seems more French, but I guess the French got a lot of that from them. And then if you combine that with the sauces, it's really nice. But anyways, on your site, too, you have like these little historical bits about spices and
yes.
things of that nature, which I found really fascinating. So like when you'll talk about nutmeg, you know, or whatever. And it's just really interesting. And, you know, the history of food really is the history of people, because wherever we've gone as humans, we had to have food available, you know, things we could eat or figure out things that we could eat. So it really can tell you a lot about a culture, about a people, as to the kinds of foods that they eat and why, maybe. Like, you know, of course, I'm not living on a diet of like whale blubber or something, like maybe the Inuit have. And then how that changes people over time, how the food they ingest changes them genetically and things like that. It's really fascinating. So I enjoy like reading through your website, because I really like history, and my memory's not so good, so I don't got all the details right sometimes. But I really love reading through those things and kind of thinking about, you know, how the how much mankind has just sort of progressed over the millennia. And you know, we have it pretty good right now, because we have spices from all over the world that we can get and make our, you know, every meal enjoyable, whereas I don't think that was the case for a lot of people in the past. They sort of had to make do with what was close until...
Right. Well, that's... So, yeah. So, if you've never cooked with a kumquat, you don't know that they exist, so you don't really know what you're missing.
Right.
So, 400, 500, 600, 700 years ago, when a lot of the things that we use, and that's not true, pepper, cardamom, vanilla, nutmeg, the whole southern tip of India and Indonesia, it's a lot of spices there.
Right.
And so figuring out this plant made something that was tasty, and how to go about turning this red berry, so red's bad, red's a sign of poison, don't eat anything red, but if you let it dry, crack the skin off, there's this little weird dried up thing inside. If you grind it, hey, that's pepper, let's make pepper.
Right.
And so between discovering that you can make this thing edible, that it is edible, that you can do something with it, and then, hey, you know what? Maybe those people over there want some. Let's go trade.
Yeah.
And so really as simple as that, trade begins. But so someone in that community walks or camels or whatever they do, some other community, well, I want some of that too. So it mm-hmm. takes some time, but then a commodity is established.
Yeah.
Well, once that commodity is established, then we go back and we see that the Portuguese, who were very good at trading, did a good job of that. And the Dutch East India Company said, well, hey, you know, we want some of that too. So, yeah, we aren't altogether that different from 500 years ago when the spice trade was extraordinarily bloody.
Yeah.
Wars over spices ensued, and it was ugly, ugly stuff.
Yeah.
So happily, we don't have that any longer. We have other problems. I did a piece on Madagascar vanilla and engaged in an email conversation with somebody very knowledgeable on Madagascar and Madagascar vanilla beans who really wanted me to take her position on Madagascar and the labor problem and there aren't really unions, but there were price controls put in.
Mm-hmm.
Which it's like, okay, hang on a minute, let's go get our economics in one lesson. Not a good idea, and turns out that wasn't a good idea. They had some problems in Madagascar with the government. They had some problems in Madagascar from hurricanes. So the price of vanilla beans has been going all over the place.
Yeah, it was like $21 for 8 ounces recently here, I think is what it was. Really high.
For extract, yes. But for the beans, it's been insane. It's been really, really high. Madagascar vanilla beans require human interaction to pollinate the flower. And then humans have to pick the beans. So it's a very high labor thing. Mexican vanilla beans, bees will do it, but there's humans still have to pick it. So Mexican vanilla beans can be a little bit cheaper than Madagascar. Mexico hasn't been decimated by two hurricanes, but Madagascar has. So, yeah, lots of troubles. And so this is life in even, 2018, we still have trouble.
Great. Yeah. I feel like there's so much more we could talk about in that, like how people even get, figure out that something poisonous, if you cook it this way, it's not anymore. But we're coming to the end of our time, unfortunately.
No, that stuff is that part of just the experimentation and what level of hunger or curiosity got somebody to dig into a cashew nut and to say the thing in the middle is edible when cashews are in the family of poison ivy, and 25% of people are not allergic to poison ivy, so 1 out of 4 was only able to hold that thing, cut it open and say, hey, look, yum.
That's amazing.
The same thing. Mangoes in the poison ivy family, so people who are allergic to mango, poison ivy, probably can't eat the mango skin, but the fruit inside is fine.
It's
fascinating stuff. It is, but it's...
Well, I know.
I don't go that far on the website. I just, the spices part, a little bit of history, a little bit of application, sometimes a little bit into homeopathy, but I'm in no way a homeopath. If you want to do it, find somebody who knows about it. It's not me, but it is out there.
Yeah.
Essential oils are useful either for good smells and a burner. Then a couple of recipes. What do you do with nutmeg? Well, here's what you can do with nutmeg.
Sure.
You can do with vanilla. Make ice cream.
It's all really, really interesting. Before we go, can you tell people, so we have the Culinary Libertarian, where people can find you online, and you also have a Facebook page. It's called Eating Liberty, or tell me.
The Eating Liberty is the Facebook group.
Yeah.
The Culinary Libertarian does have its own Facebook page, and the Eating Liberty group is... I guess attached somehow, maybe not, I don't know. I don't speak Facebook very well, but it is part of the Culinary Libertarian separate group. So when I do, when I publish an article, I post it in several groups, and Eating Liberty is one of those groups where the new blog post information is made available. So you can go read about the new recipe, read about the new spice thing. So the libertarian part of Culinary Libertarian is becoming more and more focused on food policy and those kinds of things. One of the things I found interesting was blockchain technology used to verify and authenticate country of origin and species of fish.
That's amazing. That's really amazing.
A real problem with fake fish and fake food in general, selling crappy fish for expensive fish, and even people who probably should know the difference don't know the difference. So now that someone, not the government, has figured out private enterprise rules again, has figured out a way to use this blockchain technology to tag every single fish and say, this is a red snapper, this is a black grouper, and along the way, you can check and see where it's been and what it is.
That's amazing. And I maybe we could have a conversation about that some other time. Because I think that's a really important thing for people to know too, that it's, you know, there's, you're not necessarily getting what you think you're getting all the time.
Oh boy, well, there's another book for that.
Yeah. But so is there somewhere else that you also would like people to be able to find you, or anything that you have going on?
Well, I feel like I've got 1,000 projects going on. I just started an Etsy store that's kind of fun, called Cranky Without Coffee.
That sounds like me.
sounds like every coffee yeah. drinker I know.
Yeah. Okay, great. Cranky Without
Fun
Coffee?
Libertarian is it. Cranky Without Coffee, but there's my affiliates and other things are on the website, on the blog, and by go pay a visit and get some spices.
Sure, yeah. Well, I certainly appreciate everything you're doing, you know, just to learn for one and to get out there and start something. I think that's really important to just, if people, you know, the best way to learn is to do, in my opinion. So, you know, that's a great way to do, and you make a lot of connections. And I just appreciate people who put themselves out there, because when you put yourself out there, you open yourself to ridicule and other things. And I appreciate that. So,
and you need a thick skin.
Yes. And I certainly do appreciate you coming on my show today. And
happy to do it.
Yeah. So we can have another conversation again sometime in the future, hopefully. So
absolutely.
Thank you so much, Dan. Take care.
You're very welcome. Okay.
Folks, that's going to do it for today. Check the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/13, for links to all the affiliates, books, and podcasts mentioned. It's a bit of a long show notes page today. You can also find a link to my page for the foodie or reader, or you, Santa does not mind the help, who needs something new for 2019. Head over to culinarylibertarian.com/gift. And get that last-minute thing.